We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined as always by Quinn Kesnick, who is in Midway Airport flying home from having covered the second day of the NCAA quarterfinals. Quint, a pair of overtime games. Do you get paid extra for OT games?
Unfortunately not. My voice is a little shot. We didn't have great audio today. Sometimes the crowd noise was super loud. Sometimes the music was super loud. We couldn't hear ourselves. So it felt like you were fighting. So my voice is a little shot. But what a day of drama. I mean, a lot of tension, a lot of drama.
So we are on a streak where six of the last eight quarterfinal games played have gone to overtime, which just means that we are in the halcyon days of college lacrosse. And I thought you and Anish did a nice job of both telling the story of all of this action, but also contrasting the fast-paced up-and-down action of 2019 versus the high tension of 2021. And we're going to work in reverse order, which means that we start with Anthony DeMayo's game-winning goal as the Maryland Terrapins came into overtime and turned one of their 10 face-off wins. They went 10 of 30 into a give-and-go with Logan Wisnauskas that ended the game and sent the Terps, the number 3 seed, playing on the road in the quarterfinals at Notre Dame, to the Final Four. How do you describe that last sequence?
Well, a couple things stand out. Number one, Anish was trying to hold it in and had to run to the bathroom to start overtime. which at Notre Dame, if you go back and watch the tape, I actually called the start of overtime with the faceoff. All of a sudden, I look over and we're in separate booths. So I look over and he's not there. And Adam's like, "Okay, call it." And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, this is nuts! What a time to bail!" And so it's logistically not easy. So I called the faceoff, and thankfully there he comes running back in to call the winning goal. But it was a little bizarre. You know, at the end of the day, I look at my score sheet, and Maryland dominated the first quarter, and they dominated the fourth quarter. And in between, Notre Dame dominated the second and third. You know, I thought when Notre Dame went up 12-9, they looked kind of they were hurting. They had a bunch of guys cramping up on the sideline. They had guys really not finishing their shifts well. And if they didn't win a ton of faceoffs, I sensed a Maryland comeback. And that's kind of what happened.
It's exactly what happened. It happened in like a minute and a half. Yeah. It was unbelievable. It went from 12-9 to 12-12.
It was four goals. Yeah, four goals in 3 minutes and 15 seconds. And Wierman won that faceoff in overtime easily. I don't know where that came from because that wasn't the case throughout most of the day. And we saw two given goals today. Just simple old school throw ball to the wing and give a little V-cut and present a target. Interesting how that worked, off-ball play. Both of these games I felt were half-field games. You know, there was very little up-and-down transition-type offense. There was very little early offense, fast break goals. It was good extra man play, but it was mostly 6-on-6. And at the end of the day, you know, Bernhardt is a piece that no one else has. And then the Maryland complimentary part showed up. I thought Wisnauskas played a great second half. And Moss, when given the opportunity, was pretty strong. And Kyle Long looked like he had fresh legs at the end of the game as well.
You mentioned Jared Bernhardt, and I think that's kind of the place to start when we try to diagnose this game. Coming in, the expectation was that Jack Guilty was going to card him, and he did. But Bernhardt did a really nice job of scoring unassisted goals. He finished with 5 goals, 0 assists on 7 shots. But I believe he had 4 of those 5 goals in the first half, and then his 5th came on extra man with about 10 seconds into the third quarter. So for the last 29 minutes and 50 seconds, Notre Dame's defense did a nice job on Bernhardt. And you and Anish talked at halftime about how that had to be Notre Dame's priority. And clearly it was. And clearly whatever they implemented worked. But it wasn't sufficient to win the game. And we can get to some of the elements that Maryland relied on down the stretch in a second. But why don't we talk about what you saw from Bernhardt in the first half?
Well, just when given space, he's gonna get a 2 or 3 step advantage top side to his right hand. And I've yet to see a defender really recently turn him, get to beat him to that spot and force him to inside roll. I mean, he's been able to curl right-handed or shoot off the hip of the defender consistently now. So I think the first thing going forward is You know, how are you going to defend him? Are you going to slide adjacent and give up some step downs and then rotate behind it? Or are you going to try to turn him and coma or come off your inside slide and sandwich him that way? Nobody's really had the answer. And his legs and his speed and his burst and his acceleration was just was really tough. You know, historically, Notre Dame's defense has been better when the ball's up top, and attacking them from X is typically the smart thing to do. And I think Bernhardt benefited from that as well.
We will talk about a lack of crease slide when we talk about Loyola versus Duke. But why don't we shift gears to the Notre Dame end of the field? Because obviously Pat Cavanaugh came in as a Twerton finalist, and there was an expectation that he was going to be the straw that stirred the drink for the Fighting Irish. But in fact, it was their midfield who really provided a lot of the scoring punch. I think most folks, if you told them that Notre Dame was going to score 13 goals, would have said that the Fighting Irish were going to win. Wheaton Jacobois led with 4 goals. Eric Dobson had 2 and 1. His 2 goals were the loudest 2 goals, right? Like the opposite of the quiet goal, right? And then Griffin Westland had a goal and 3 assists. Kavanaugh limited to a goal and 2 assists. Notre Dame just did a nice job with kind of the balanced offense. They did not lose this game because of their inability to score goals.
No, they attacked the shorties pretty well, I thought, with the weave up top and got some decent looks. You know, Maryland probably misses Jake Higgins some from the defensive midfield position. But at the end of the day, I got to give credit to Alex Smith and Roman Puglisi, because I thought they dug in and won the fourth quarter, won those matchups in the fourth quarter, when in the third quarter it wasn't looking good. You know, Dobson scores unassisted. Dobson scores again to give him a 9-8 lead. Lipka on a nice pass from Westland. And so Notre Dame had the midfield offense cooking in the second and third quarters, and that seemed to go away in the fourth quarter. I thought Smith, man, he was so tough on the ball. That two-handed wrap check he has, and Puglisi, those guys battled, and they ran a lot of lacrosse. They had a lot of shifts. They did not get much time off, and they ultimately made an extra play or two in the fourth quarter, which was a deciding factor. I thought both goalies ramped it up in this game. I thought McNaney wasn't as sharp in the second quarter, but he played a strong second half, especially out of the net, where he came up with a couple key grounders and made some nice outlet passes. And then Entenmann was good throughout this game. He gave his team a chance to win the game. He made some spectacular saves, I thought, when this game could have gone sideways on him. You know, the 5-1 mark, things weren't looking good for Notre Dame. And he stood tall, and it seemed like the defense picked up confidence behind his play in the second and third quarters.
McNaney finished with 10 saves. Entenmann finished with 16. And I agree with you. Particularly, you started talking about the fatigue that Notre Dame was experiencing. And it wasn't just at the defensive end, but obviously if it's manifest all over the field, it's most dangerous at the defensive end. With about 12 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, and there were 2 or 3 possessions that Entenmann saved that could have kind of made this margin so big that it wasn't even feasible to make it to overtime. So certainly also the goalie position, not the deciding factor in the outcome of this game. You mentioned McNaney was really good in the clearing game. There were a couple of instances in which he tracked down ground balls outside of the crease, and they were the types of ground balls when you would expect him to come up with it first time, but then get it checked out of his stick. But he did a really nice job either throwing face dodges or just using a head fake to buy space in order to get rid of a pass and set up a clear that ultimately Maryland was able to succeed, regardless of whether or not it was easy or difficult.
Those are big plays. Remember, you know, the goalie, he's kind of a free safety because he's the extra guy. He's the seventh man. And I always felt when I played, especially in summer ball, heat games, when everyone was getting tired, then the second half was your opportunity because theoretically your legs were fresher than everyone else's. So if we entered the game with the same time in the 10-meter dash or the 20-meter, by the end of the game, if that guy's been running all game and I've been in the crease all game, I'm probably going to have a step or two on him because my legs are fresh and sharp. And so what I liked about McNaney was how decisive he was. Yeah, he didn't overthink it. He saw the opportunity, came out aggressively, made the play, and he made the right turn. You know, a lot of times I see goalies scoop up the ball and then turn towards the head of their stick and get sandwiched. But he scooped, turn away, and then he was looking opposite. So that was those are subtle plays that make a big difference in a close game like that.
You ready to talk about Maryland's opponent, or do you have anything else on this one?
Yeah, no. You know, I tell you, I felt the home field advantage in the second quarter when Notre Dame was down 5-1 and rallied. And then after the game, when Maryland was celebrating, man, they were getting after some of the fans that were perched behind the goal. So that was quite a win for the Maryland program to go on the road as a lower seed on a hot day, to deal with the travel, to deal with, you know, the adversity. They were given an excuse, and excuses are for wussies, and they didn't take the excuses. So I got a lot of credit for the way they gutted this one out.
There were a handful of instances, particularly early, maybe the first 20 minutes of the game, where it felt like this was really contentious, really ugly, trash talking,
yes,
taking things personally.
Yes. The hits.
Yes.
If I'm going to get a foul, like, you're going to give me a minute, well, I'm going to make it worth my time. I mean, Puglisi grabbed Dobson by that, basically headlocked him and threw him down to the ground. Both games, the Wires penalty on Sowers was as vicious a hook as we've ever seen, and turned out to be a brilliant, smart play, believe it or not. But this game, it's like, if you're going to get a foul, take his head off. There was no, like, medium fouls. Everything was extremely well done, and finish the guy off.
It is now officially Maverick May Madness on InsideLacrosse.com. And the new Maverick EKG shoulder pads and chest protector are here for all players. Get upgraded performance protection that meets the new Noxy safety standards. Shop the whole line on lax.com/EKG. I don't think we have said that Maryland won this game 14-13. So let's correct that potential podcast mistake early with this Duke Loyola matchup that started Sunday. The Blue Devils won 10-9 in overtime, thanks to yet again another Joe Robertson finish. This one on Duke's second possession of the period after they had won the opening faceoff, turned the ball over. The Greyhounds got a shot. And I will say, we're going to talk about three overtime games. And even though Notre Dame didn't touch the ball in overtime, they did have the ball at the end of regulation in order to win it. So for those who complain about the NFL's overtime rules where a team can lose without touching the ball, it's fortunate that in all three overtime games we had this weekend, none of those complaints are able to persist. But with respect to...
that was well defended by Maryland. They did a good job. Multiple Notre Dame Dodgers tried to get topside dead center, you know, at about 15 and couldn't penetrate.
With respect to Duke's win, I mean, for as much as we're going to talk about the Blue Devils, this is a Loyola team that was 5-5 and not in the NCAA tournament conversation a little bit more than 6 weeks ago. I mean, just to put it like the finest point possible on it, Kyle LeBlanc, the defenseman who played in his first game since April 10th, being injured against Army, was the defender who both was involved in dislodging Michael Sowers to set up Loyola's opportunity to win on their possession overtime, and then ultimately was covering Joe Robertson for that game-winning goal. Kyle LeBlanc has not been involved in any of Loyola's five consecutive wins to put them in position to play this game. I mean, the turnaround that this team has experienced is remarkable, and the fact that they played this super team as close as you possibly can is a testament to Charlie Toomey and his staff and the job that they did this season.
They could have won this game. They really could have. I thought they played well enough in the fourth quarter to give themselves a chance, tied it up at 7, tied it up at 8, took a lead, 9-8. You know, the overtime goal is one of those. In overtime, it's hard to get guys to slide. You know, nobody wants to be responsible for
leaving a man. Dino was talking about this post game. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so offensively, I think you got to click into the mindset like of, if I can get an edge, they're probably going to be slow to go. No one wants to accept blame. Like, I left my guy in the crease and he scored a layup. And that's the mindset defensively. And Robertson's been able to capitalize on that 3 times. This shot, you know, super slow, but very well-placed and tricky bounce.
Okay, let's not exaggerate. He was falling down, and he just kind of flung his stick. The ball went straight into the ground and bounced over Sam Schaefer's shoulder. He made 17 saves. My question for you is, there were a lot of comments on social media after the game that I saw that were to the effect of, that's a horrible way to lose, in the sense that the ball barely made the net move.
It was a better shot than Duke won on at Hofstra in, what was that, 2018 or 19, when they beat Notre Dame?
My question is, does the soft It's not a soft goal in the sense that, like, it just had the angle.
Any shot on goal in overtime that's not directed at the goalie's stick is a good shot.
Exactly.
Trust me. I've given up enough. Two of my seasons were ended on playoff overtime goals. Trust me. So I give them credit. Now, you know, Duke's offense didn't look good in this game. I got to tell you. Sowers had a dodging advantage in this game that was so crystal clear. And he could dust his man, and yet Duke got nothing from it. They got very little from it. I don't know what's going on with their patterns, the lack of step downs, the lack of him wanting to throw a skip. I haven't seen him throw an effective skip from lower right, let's say, when he curls right-handed to the left wing or upper left, really. Everything's inside. And at Princeton, that worked because guys were cutting. They were in this amoeba, this spaghetti-like offense that everyone was working off of him. And Duke doesn't do that. And so he beats his guy, double comes, and, like, everyone's just kind of standing around, not presenting a target, not finding lanes, not working with him, not timing their cuts to his movement. Honestly, Duke's 6-on-6 set wasn't good today. And then you add to that their lack of transition. They rarely break out from D to O. They don't manufacture goals off the ride. So they're relying on 6-on-6 for other goals, and that's why they only end up with 10, I think. I walk away shaking my head like, I'm not sure Duke's settled offense is that great. The pieces should be much better than it is. That's what I'm trying to say. They got pieces that settled offense should be outstanding, and right now it's not.
Duke did not manifest transition offense except for the two instances in which they absolutely needed to. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Loyola's resilience, their ability to answer the bell. But I can't talk about it without mirroring the fact that Duke did it even more substantially, because Loyola ties it at 5-5. Tyler Carpenter just bursts out of nothing, picks up this incredible ground ball, and finds Mike Sowers on the crease for an easy doorstep finish. And then Loyola ties it 7-7. The ball moves to Brandon O'Neill. He throws a no-no yes pass to Brian Smythe, who was... I apologize to the Smith / Smythe family. I don't know whether it's Smythe or Smith, but either way, Brian Smith / Smythe with a Y, open on the crease. First of all, very confusing why he was on the field, because he is a reserve faceoff specialist. But according to this...
They were using him on the wing.
Exactly.
Using him on the wing at times.
He did not take the faceoff. He was just cutting to the crease, and he caught and finished an incredibly low-angle shot, cutting to GLE, and put Duke up 8-7. Those were the two most important plays of the game, because to the extent that Loyola built momentum, they were not able to extend their momentum, because Duke scored two transition goals off of either an exceptional or courageous play, and it's hard to run the counterfactual of what happens if those two plays don't happen. But on the basis of the game flow over the course of the other 59 plus minutes, if those two plays don't happen, Loyola wins this game in my book, because they did a really nice job with carrying momentum, except for those two instances.
And think about Duke's midfielders. What did Duke get from their midfielders today? Denenza scores the first goal.
That's it. That is literally it. Smythe.
Brian Smith scores the eighth goal, and that's it. If you said, hey, Charlie Toomey, you're going to hold Duke to 10 goals, Nekhai Montgomery, 0 points, Dyson Williams, 0 points, Lowry, zero,
Lowry should have had one. Sam
Riley,
Schaefer had an incredible save on him.
Like, all these guys, Basile, none. Like, you'd like your chances. And then the fact that Sowers only scored, once?
Yeah, he had one. He had three assists, but he had one goal.
You know, O'Neal was kind of the X factor.
O'Neal was awesome, but he was awesome for like
six-minute
stretch.
Four. Honestly, I thought if they played it better again, he could have had six.
He had ten.
Was wide open.
He could have had
wide
10
open
goals
on all sorts of skips. Every time they invert and they sent the double, he curled left-handed. He's standing up top at 15, like completely open.
And he didn't even dodge.
Yeah, no, it was a bizarre game that way. But you do got to give Loyola a lot of credit.
But
isn't
this exactly the way the last five games have gone? You and I have talked about
this. Oh, no, it was
like,
the same.
I don't know how.
I was watching Loyola Denver.
How
did
they win
Loyola
these
Denver
games? You know what I mean? It was like they Jedi mind tricked their opponents into playing into their hands in terms of both the offensive and defensive matchups.
I said, you know, Duke's going to turn up the heat. Like Virginia turned up the heat on Georgetown. And they make this an athletic game. Make it a full 60-minute pedal to the metal. Give up some goals along the way. Get out and press them. You know, double team them. Be aggressive. Use your athletic ability. And they didn't. They backed off and really let Loyola operate in comfort with their invert game. It was a little weird. And Loyola shot making in their five-game win streak was terrific. It was super clutch. Ice in their veins, Olmstead, James, Lindley, these guys were extremely poised, and the plan worked.
The one distinction I want to draw is there was no fear in this Greyhound team. I was texting with a bunch of other D1 coaches whose teams either weren't in or had been knocked out of the tournament.
No.
They were watching this game, and they were the same guys I was texting with yesterday watching Virginia Georgetown, and the tone of their comments couldn't have been more stark. This is a Loyola team that has been there before, and they were playing like they had been there before, and they were playing like they expected to win.
They're playing to win. Yeah, they're playing to win. And again, like when you enter the playoffs, you have to be grateful and thankful. You have to commit to playing the full 60. You can't have the fear of making a mistake or losing. And I think we saw some of the favored higher-seeded teams as these games dragged on into the third and fourth quarter, all of a sudden they're gripping their sticks tight, whether it was Carolina against Rutgers, whether it was Duke. Thought you saw in the first round with the Notre Dame Drexel game and the Bryant-Virginia game. So, you know, that onus, that expectation of victory becomes a curse for teams if they're only up by one, they're only up by two. You know, Duke was up. Duke shut out Loyola for, what, 20-something, 22 minutes in this game.
And they couldn't separate.
By one.
Yeah.
Couldn't separate. You got to separate. How many times do you shut a team out for 22 minutes and then next thing you know, it's tied? That's rare. That's, I guess, credit to Loyola's defense who hung tough during that drought.
There were a lot of similarities in the Carolina Rutgers game and the Loyola Duke game in the way that the pace of scoring increased as the quarters went along. And it's hard to, in my opinion, diagnosed the extent to which that was the offense taking more chances, playing with a little more desperation, versus figuring out what defenses were trying to do and figuring out which matchups were going to be most successful.
I think it's a little of everything, but John Torpy put it well when High Point decided to kind of slow things down to rest their defense. He said, by the fourth quarter, if you're playing too much defense, you lose a yard. You lose a yard on all your approaches.
Closeouts.
You lose a yard on perimeter pressure. You lose, and so that yard means a lot in the fourth quarter. So as your defense gets tired, the offense a little more familiar with how it's going to look, how it's going to feel, how your slides are going to be timed. That combined with fatigue, I think, opens things up in the fourth quarter.
North Carolina won 12-11. At Hofstra on Saturday afternoon as Connor McCarthy, the Princeton grad transfer, scored the overtime game winner. Whew, that was something. It was on the heels of a Rutgers possession in which Chris Gray crossed the midfield line, caused a turnover by Connor Kearst. There was a lot of controversy over whether or not Rutgers should have, or even in some instances did, call a timeout that was not recognized. Coach Brian Breck told me post-game, not directly, but in so many words, that he wasn't looking to call timeout in that situation, that he trusts his players in their ability to make the right decision. But ultimately, the ball worked back to the Tar Heels and set up McCarthy, who missed the game against Monmouth a week ago. But he opened the scoring in this one, and then he closed the scoring with the overtime game winner. In the middle, Justin Anderson, the dad, who just delivered a baby 9 days ago, had three goals. And Lance Tillman, the sophomore swing attackman slash midfielder who was the Tar Heels' 13th leading scorer coming into this game with five goals and two assists, was absolutely the North Carolina's most important player, scoring four goals in the game.
Yeah, Carolina's legs didn't look great in this game. I thought they played not to lose, kind of uncharacteristically, not brazen and brash and making plays and challenging and you know, playing with that swashbuckling style. But at the end of the day, their depth of scoring bailed them out. They had eight goals from non-starters. Rutgers only had one. Rutgers' attack has proven, and I thought really proved to be a lethal matchup for everybody. But Rutgers didn't have the same kind of depth of scoring. The other thing I thought the guys did a nice job with that game, watching it with Anish in Elkhart, Indiana, which is 30 minutes outside of South Bend, was the failure to clear, and it didn't show up in the stats, but that's kind of a malfunction.
We talked about that on the first podcast of this season.
Yeah, exactly. So the deal there is Rutgers' attack needs to bust upfield and front swing or V-cut to avail themselves to bail out a long pole or defensive middy who's getting pressured. And you saw it with Kavanaugh today. That was always really in the era that I played for at Johns Hopkins, that was always really harped on the attack. When you see a long pole approaching the midfield line,
or
get on your horse, you know, get on your horse and you know, bail that guy out. And so didn't see enough of that from a Rutgers attack. Again, that's combined, 79 years old or something?
Rutgers.
73. Sorry, I got it wrong.
Rutgers got 16 saves from Colin Kearse, your boy, your favorite goalie in this entire college lacrosse season. But most surprisingly, they
didn't get drafted in the PLL. Didn't get drafted.
He'll get
didn't
picked up.
Didn't get drafted. He'll be in a camp. He's good for that league because he can handle. He's got good size. I love some of the slow motion replays of his save making. His ability to wait and then react. Super balanced. Great. Really smooth. He was on two of the goals. He was on the game winner. He just went under instead of over, and he was on an earlier shot that went in stick side low. It hit his stick pretty good too. So he was on two of the goals. And that's something you look for in goalies too. Even when you give up a goal, was the goalie on it? You know, in practice, I can remember guys would be, yeah, I scored on you. I'm like, I was on it. And if you're on it, eventually you're going to make that save. So, you know, it's like a guy foul tipping in baseball. Like he's on your best stuff. He's not swinging and missing entirely.
And Kearse was not the only specialty position that was a strength for the Scarlet Knights in this one, because Jonathan DeGenio, he won 15 to 27 faceoffs and picked up 7 ground balls.
He was dominating the clamp. He was dominating the whistle. He looked as if, remember how good he was the first couple weeks of the season?
Yes.
He was really good their first two or three games. He was a big storyline, and then he kind of hit a wall. I don't know if it was a scouting thing in that league, because the Big Ten did have good Fogos this year, or the book was out on him or something, or maybe it was an injury. We don't know. But he found that prior form, and that was a surprise, and that really frustrated Carolina, because they're a get the ball, score, go on a run, play free type team.
With the exception of one very important moment when Zach Tucci hadn't been utilized so he finished 4 of 8. He was 1 of 5, which means he went 3 of 3 in his last 3 faceoffs.
Yeah.
I don't know when this faceoff occurred, like how many of Andrew Tyre's faceoffs had already elapsed at this point, but Tucci, I remember looking at the stats. I was like, they got to try him again. Like, I understand he's 1 for 5, but you got to try him again, because I think it was a situation where I thought, like, Tyre looked tired going after a ground ball on the far sideline. And I was like, all right, well, you've got this other guy who you've relied on all year. Just give him a shot and see what happens. He was on the field 2 or 3 faceoffs later, one forward, scored a goal. And the broadcast, once again, did a nice job of showing this, immediately ran back to the dot. And John Donowski has a rule where if you're a faceoff guy who scores, you come out of the game. And Tucci was saying very clearly, like, I am taking this next faceoff, and he won it. And I don't recall what happened on the subsequent possession, but obviously it was a factor in...
He won the draw.
Yeah.
He won the next draw.
I'm sorry, I don't remember what happened after he won the draw. I don't know whether Carolina scored in that possession or not, but ultimately it led to a Carolina win.
I thought a storyline in the last two games was Rutgers' defense.
They did a really good job.
Structured defense. They did a really good job in the playoffs, dominating Lehigh, really, really making Colin Kearse's job easy. And then same against Carolina. They held up. They held up in all these matchups. And going in, I didn't think they could do that. I just thought Carolina would put a lot of pressure on them. And the better they did, the tighter Carolina got. Carolina's shot selection wasn't great. Tanner Cook being in and out of the lineup, he showed some rust. They didn't get much out of that low lefty position, and so Tillman bailed them out in a lot of ways. But the Rutgers defense deserves a lot of credit for the way they finished up the season.
The lone remaining game of the weekend, the Virginia Cavaliers topped the Georgetown Hoyas 14-3. And we can diagnose this as much as we want to, but I'm not certain how much more it requires other than it was just one of those games. It was one of those days.
Yeah. Everyone put a lot of significance into an injury. I downplay that because, I don't know, you watch the game and
you're talking about James Riley, right?
And yeah, it still may be a game at 3-1, and then all of a sudden it spirals out of control. The issue was playing Connor Schellenberger, the matchups, the lack of double teams, the lack of pick defense for Georgetown.
Oh, my God.
In combination with winning any kind of 50-50 play in the middle of the field. I mean, Virginia just mauled them on all those plays. So, you know, Riley, yeah, that can take your win. That can knock wins out of your sail. But that team's defense has been their core. And so even if they lost two-thirds of the faceoffs, I thought they could stand up and make some stops. But that was the worst I've seen Georgetown's defense look in a long time. It was bad, both individually and team-wise.
So a couple things. The first is, after Georgetown lost to Loyola, Kevin Warren came on the post-game press conference and said, that's the worst game we played this year by far. And that was it. Like, he didn't really have anything else to add to that. That Loyola performance was 10 times better than this Virginia performance from Georgetown overall. The second thing is, have you ever had one of those days where you get out of bed and you just feel kind of lethargic and you look at the clock and it's noon and you woke up at 7, but you feel like you've only been awake for an hour because your brain was just moving slow? That was how I felt on Saturday morning. And so maybe it's projection, but it felt like that's how Georgetown as a team also felt on Saturday morning. Like,
yeah.
And there were other elements that played into this. I mean, Kevin Warren got hit in the head with a ricochet shot in warmups that took him to his knees. And I don't want to like overstate the importance of that, but like to the extent that it's emblematic, James Riley has possession of the ball on the opening faceoff and he gets pushed relatively innocuously right in front of his team's bench on the opening faceoff of the game. And the way that he reacted to that injury, I thought he dislocated his hip. I thought it was like a Bo Jackson level career-ending injury. He came back on the field a couple plays later. I mean, he took like the fourth faceoff of the game. So clearly it wasn't that. Ultimately, what it came down to, Jake Giuliani catches, I think it was a Grant Bundy step down out of the air when... was it Jackson Appelt who had the catch off of the clearing pass that Olin McElroy tried to throw, and then he has an easy finish on the doorstep? Like, there were
that was
all
Xander Dixon.
I'm sorry.
Pocket.
Yeah,
yeah.
There are all these compounding factors where it just felt like a combination of Virginia's
True.
Day and Georgetown's not day.
Yeah, you know, I think it goes back to the week. I think it goes back. Just put the prior game under a microscope a little more. They beat Syracuse, a team who basically quit 18-10. They kept their starters in the whole game. They didn't use their bench. There's no reason to beat them by 10, 18-8. That game should have been more like a 14-10.
Well, it should have been exactly like what Virginia did against Georgetown.
I thought they put up the flare bright and clear and got Virginia's attention. They also were celebrating that game as if it was the greatest thing since sliced bread, which it was for their program. But sometimes I think you know, what goes on during the week is going to show up on game day. And all those factors, I think, thrown into a mix, create this horrible, horrible tasting stew that was tough to swallow.
Have you ever eaten bad stew?
No, I mean, your week of preparation, you know, it starts with the
feeling. No, literally. Have you ever eaten, like, a stew that you're
no.
just like, oh, ugh, ugh.
No.
Seems like something out of a Disney movie. You know, like a bubbling cauldron.
Again, it's a great learning experience. You know, so often in that Georgetown game, they had freshmen marked up, whether it was Leary or Tom Linovich, in key spots, and they were exposed. And so adding Will Bowen next year really changes all their matchups. It'll be a big positive for them, both from a size, physicality standpoint, and then the trickle-down for everyone's matchup becomes more manageable.
It is an interesting intersection.
I think it's a 3-goal swing for them. I think it's a 3-goal. I think Will Bowen's worth at least 3 goals to that organization.
When you consider what Loyola is going to bring back, Olmstead, Lindley, McNulty, it sounds like Schaefer might come back. I don't know about Savio. I don't know. I'm pretty sure Wires has years left. I don't think he's an actual true senior anyway. So Loyola is basically bringing everybody back. Georgetown is bringing pretty much everybody other than Caraway and then Pekovic, who obviously transferred in, back. Those two teams have very bright futures. Notre Dame got a lot of contributions out of guys who will not be on this team next year. Same thing for Rutgers. When you consider the quarterfinal losers and what they're going to have to do in order to be prepared to win next year, the question is, are Notre Dame and Rutgers going to be able to duplicate their success in the grad transfer portal? And for those who are complaining, and I received a number of text messages and Twitter mentions about this topic specifically, about the prevalence of the super team and the formula that these groups have in order to be successful, it's just interesting.
I don't think it'll be as strong going forward, but I still think that the two schools, Duke and Notre Dame, with those one-year graduate programs
in business,
are going to benefit the most. They're going to benefit the most. There's absolutely – Notre Dame did a great job of targeting needs, and they'll do the same thing this year. I can't imagine that Duke will bring in 5 or 6. I mean, they had 16 grad students this year. And so that'll continue. I think you'll see some more D2 and D3 impact transfers. You're going to see more top 10 guys who are on the 60-man rosters who weren't getting enough PT end up at more mid-tier programs. So this free agency is here to stay for at least the next 5 years.
Quint, are you trying to tell people to stay tuned to InsideLacrosse.com for all of your latest news in the transfer portal?
What I want to do, I got to get the address for the portal, because like I wake up every day now in May and June wondering who's in the portal today. It's fascinating. If you need like an extra ops person just to keep your eye on evaluating this talent. Now think about it, if you're an assistant coach, some guy hits the portal from Lynchburg you never heard of. You got to go watch some games. It's very much like the NFL, player management, player evaluations.
Yeah, it's what do they call it? League scouting. There's a term for
pro exactly.
Scouting,
and then giving a value for every player and a worth and a fit, and then checking the intangibles. What type of locker room guy is? Does anyone on our team know him from high school? Did we recruit him in the first place? Did we like this guy and got away from us? Or is this guy a bad cat and we don't want him in our program? Is he going to come here and destroy our locker room? Like, this is nuanced, complicated, layered. There's a lot for coaches to figure out.
Turning our attention to Saturday, we have North Carolina versus Virginia, a rematch of two teams that have already played twice and they split. I assume this is going to be the first game since those two teams played on Saturday, and then Duke Maryland will be on the late game. What are your expectations for what we're going to see at Renshaw Field in East Hartford, Connecticut?
Wow. So you gave me a 2-hour drive to think that one over in rainstorms and Chicago traffic.
You got white knuckles?
Yeah, it's never easy. I got in an accident driving to Tennessee this year during college football season. It was my first time in like 20 years of getting. I got rear-ended by this woman who was just not paying attention, and what a pain in the neck that was. So I'm a little paranoid right now with my rental cars. But okay, expectations. Well, if you go on a 1 week, Virginia's playing better than Carolina, but I think Carolina bounces back.
Is there any reason that you would expect a team that played an overtime game to play better or worse? Or do you just kind of like, I guess my question is, does Virginia have an advantage?
Again, it's the expectation, Terry, the expectation of being the favorite is a heavy burden sometimes. It's easy to get the chip. Oh, no one respected us. Quint said we sucked. Terry Foy.
I picked against him.
I picked against him. Exactly. Like, these guys will use anything to get a chip. I wake up in the morning and I play Kevin's Warren, today is the day. That's my tip every day. I play, hey, today is the day. Nobody wanted you. Nobody told you you're good enough. Well, today is the day we show them that we're good enough. Just play that to yourself every day.
Does Kevin Warren literally call you every morning and say that? Because I wouldn't put it past him.
No, I have it on my phone. And anytime I need motivation to go work out, I just play that. And it gets me fired up.
Oh, man. Are you excited?
I'm excited. Yeah, you know, it'll be interesting. I don't know what the fan situation is. I think it's turning for the good up in Connecticut. I'll fly up on Thursday afternoon, Thursday evening. Probably got to test before I go on maybe Monday, and then test once I get there. Rentschler Stadium, grass field. We were there for the quarters in 19, I believe.
Not a lot of shade.
When Loyola played Penn State, and
Penn played Yale.
Great game against Yale.
Yeah.
I think it was staying downtown. I think West Hartford is where the action is. Some good restaurants. Clark cutting Anisha's hair on Sunday, and championship weekend. We'll have a lot of folks from Bristol over from the headquarters. Many probably watching lacrosse for the first time in person, which will be good.
Can you believe we made it?
Yeah, and we're gaining steam. Knock on wood. I got two or three more tests I got to pass. Tested in the hotel the other day. You know, survive in advance. It was good to be in person this week. Saw a ton of parents, the McNulty's, a lot of Loyola parents. Saw all of the Notre Dame people today. There's, man, you should watch the parents during a close overtime game. they're like, I got moms hugging each other before overtime. Like, if this goes south, I may never see you again. Type stuff. Like, think about senior moms, you know, like who spent the last 4 years together hugging before overtime. Because they know that if the ending gets ugly, there's a chance that there's no tailgate, there's no team party when COVID. Like, this could be the last time I ever see you. You know, it's
amazing.
It's fascinating.
It's amazing that we put so much emotion into something that lives on such a fine knife's edge, like what you just described. But on the other hand, it makes perfect sense because that's why you do it, because it is this exciting. It is this easy to emotionally invest in it.
Yeah, and winning this thing's hard. I mean, I was watching the MIAA championships on Friday night, and you know, when I coached in that league for 12 years, man, winning that league is so hard. And winning a national championship is so difficult. I mean, we're only halfway. These teams are only halfway home, and they've already been through a ton. They've been through a difficult season, a challenging season like none other. And I honestly think that this group, these groups of teams who persevered through the season, the benefits in their lives are going to be gigantic, both from, you know, the discipline that they learned, the teamwork, the sacrifice, the how uncomfortable everything was, how isolated everything was. If you didn't make it through this year, there's nothing that you're going to encounter later on in life that's going to get in your way, and you're going to look as a barrier or as a roadblock. So those, you know, those teams that have persevered and done well this year, I got so much respect for. I know it's tested the coaches. I know it's tested the captains. I know it's tested the parents. It's tested us as fans, but we're all so much stronger for it.
Quint, as always, we appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Thank you for checking out the quick restart. We've got one more for you this year, at least. I mean, we might do some news updates as we get through June and July.
You know, nothing would make us happier, I think, that if we got a good showing of fans in Connecticut. You know, I don't know what the restrictions are going to be, but we got a good showing of fans. Those games go national on the big stage, and there's people there with great enthusiasm. I think that speaks highly of what we've been able to accomplish this year. So that's what I hope. I know we're going to have great games. I just hope the pageantry is equivalent.
If you like what you heard, leave a rating and a review. Tell a friend, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.
Mask up. One more week. We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.